Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to a New Day radio show where the dialogue is authentic, host is passionate, and we help you to become empowered, inspired, resilient, and transformed. Yes, our focus is to change our world by transforming one business and one life at a time. Now, here is your host, author, columnist, reinvention coach, entrepreneur, teacher, and speaker, Dr. Daphne Clark Hudson.
Well, good morning and happy Wednesday to you. I must welcome Hip Hop Soul Beats to the chat. Thank you for joining us today. Today we have a great show lineup for you. We will be continuing the conversation we started last week, How the Wise Decide. The lessons of 21 extraordinary leaders. However, I encourage you to call in 646-915-8166 so you can be part of the conversation as well, because I want to include your insights, so I hope I get to hear from you. And as I promised my listener, I will continue to play the theme song. So right now I'll play the theme song, Wanna Be More, and then we are going to go into some announcements, and then we will go into the conversation for today. So stay tuned.
Some friends you gain, some you lose. In the back of your mind, you're looking for love, but found the blues. That's why I've come from far away, to take away the blues. And I've come to say, I wanna be more than just somebody. I wanna be more than just a friend. I wanna be more than someone special, 'cause special friends sometimes they won't understand.
Well, and as always, that is our commitment to you. We want to do the best for you, that we can help you to transform your life and your business. I went last weekend, Friday, I attended the National Conference for the National Association of Professional Women. And I tell you, I just want to congratulate the team for putting on such a phenomenal, phenomenal conference. It was off the chain. I tell you, we had amazing women there at that conference. And I just want to tell you about some of the women who was there. The theme of the conference first was a spark, igniting your network. And the conference host was Star Jones Esquire. We had, and here's the lineup. We had Arianna Huffington. We had Martha Stewart. And those two phenomenal women were the keynote speakers. And Then we had a power panel. And I tell you, this was my first time going to this conference. On the power panel, we had Leslie Jane Seymour. And Leslie Jane Seymour is the editor-in-chief of More Magazine. And followed on the power panel, we had Monique L. Nielsen. And Monique is chairman and chief executive officer of the Uni World Group. The next two women on the power panel were Desiree Rogers, CEO of Johnson Publishing Company, and Kim Garst, who is the CEO of Boom Social. I tell you, this conference had in excess of 1,500 women. And then we had these women who did different presentations. We had Bonnie Marcus. We had Danielle Miller. We had Anna Berry, who was the narrator, moderator for the conference. And I was blessed to be in her presentation. And also, I'm blessed to spend 45 minutes with Sue Stranick, who is the founder of Inspiring Results. I tell you, one more powerful woman was Kathleen Barton. And this was a conference not to miss. So if you are a woman anywhere in the United States, I encourage you, find a chapter where you are and connect with it. It's napw.com. So you can check their website out. I am blessed to be the president of the Litchfield County chapter here in Connecticut. So anyone who is listening to this conversation right now, I invite you to come out to our meet and greet on the 28th of May at the Litchfield Inn, 4432 Bantam Road in Litchfield. I want to see you out there. We are doing all we can to build our chapter. So look forward to seeing you there. We come out, networking starts at 5:30 p.m. And everyone, we go into the restaurant for hors d'oeuvres or dinner, and then we go into our meeting. We are having a guest speaker on the 28th who is going to be speaking about the importance of taking a break to pamper yourself. The next thing I want to share with you is that June of 2014, I will be doing a cruise to Europe, and you will be hearing more about it in the upcoming weeks when my consultant comes on the show to share it with you. I'm also in a few weeks going to be doing a one-day webinar, a health webinar, to talk about. Everybody see that I have took a lot of pounds off and I'm looking fabulous, if I may say so myself. And I want to share that with you, how I am embracing the new look and the new me. I am still looking for volunteers, both for my radio show and for my TV, my local TV show. So I want you to email me or message me on Facebook or on the radio show so I can give you more details. Okay, I have to tell you all, last night I did not sleep, and I'll tell you why. You all, I think I've shared it sometimes back, that my cat Toby has a friend that comes to visit every day at night. This other cat comes and scratches on the glass door in the back. Well, here's what happened. Toby is black with white on his paws and right down his belly, from his neck down to his belly is white. So the top portion of Toby is black. Well, here's what happened. I had a taping last night, got home from the studio around about 9:30 p.m. And of course, I do not have sensors on my lights outside, and I did not turn the light on. So when I opened my door to come in, I just came in, and I did not realize that Toby sneaked out in the dark when I opened the door. It was not until 1 a.m. when I was ready to go to bed, and as I always, I called Toby, "Let's go, Toby, let's go to bed. Come on, let's go." And I'm calling Toby, no Toby. And I'm saying, where could he be? I look at all these special places that he always loves to lay. No Toby. Trust me, by now it's 1:15, 1:30 going on 2. And I'm outside calling, "Come, Toby." And I heard Toby. When I look outside, Toby and the other cat, they are coming towards me. And I have some food in the container and I'm shaking it. "Come, Toby, come. Come to mommy. Come, Toby." And just to fast forward and not to bore you, Toby did not come in. So I came in, closed my doors, tried to go to bed. Couldn't sleep because I was worried. This cat is an indoor cat. Never been outside walking around. Sometimes in the summer, I put him outside in the cage so he could enjoy some sunshine. Well, I was so happy this morning when I woke up and went outside to call Toby. Toby came because I guess he went through some trauma of being outside last night. It was cold. He was not accustomed to outside. So when I called him this morning, he came to me and he's safe. He has no injuries or anything. So although I lost sleep worrying about him, I am happy that Toby has been safe. So that is just my little story. I have to share that with you because you're all family. Now, before I go into the conversation about how the wise decide, I want to share a few quotes from Success Quotes for Achievers. And this book is written by Darren Hardy, who is the president and CEO of Success Magazine. So I want to share. The first one I want to share is from Theodore Roosevelt, and it reads, "The most important single ingredient in the formula of success is knowing how to get along with people." Dale Carnegie quotes, "You can make more friends in 2 months by becoming interested in other people than you can in 2 years trying to get other people interested in you." It's all about the relationship. Maya Angelou says, "If you find it in your heart to care for somebody else, you will have succeeded." Abraham Lincoln, "Destroyed I destroyed by my enemies, I destroyed by my enemies when I make them my friends." "Each person represents a world in us. A world possibly not born until they arrive." Anis Nin. Lord Chesterfield, "You must look into people as well as they, as well as at them. Napoleon Hill, the more gold has been mined from the thoughts of men than has been taken from the earth. And I want to share one from Ty Mexter. True self-worth, success, and wealth can only come from the responsible love, care, and compassion thoughts and action. And those are just a few of the quotes I shared for you. And as you know, each episode we have different sponsors that sponsor our shows. And if you are looking to promote your business, I encourage you to email me, dynamicdaphne1@gmail.com, and I'll tell you more information how you can become a sponsor for the show and have your business promoted. And so with that being said, this episode of the New Day Show is brought to you by AMD Law Group.
AMD Law Group is an international law practice committed to assisting you in realizing your strategic business goals. Led by Ms. Aurelia Mitchell Durant, Senior Managing Partner, AMD Law specializes in international business, international intellectual property, and general internet law. We also support organizations in resolving corporate compliance issues. Addressing the legal needs of technology firms and other businesses serving both domestic and international markets, we are uniquely positioned to assist both startups and long-established organizations. Although AMD seeks to proactively avoid litigation wherever possible, we are fully capable and ready to litigate on your behalf. AMD Law Group. Find us online at amdlawgroup.com or contact us at 347-699-4AMD. That's 347-699-4263. Let us help you pursue and protect your dreams.
Yes, so that's our sponsor. As we once a month we have one of the attorneys on to give us different insight. Last week we had the senior partner, attorney Aurelia Mitchell Durant, came on and spoke about internet law. So if you were not able to listen to that live, I suggest that you catch last week's episode on the archive, because they gave some very good pointers about internet law. Vikiki Lady, welcome to the show. All right, so last week we started the conversation on how the wise decide. And I'm continuing the conversation. I think we're going to be doing this for a round of, it looks like somewhere about 8 weeks. Thank you. It's nice to find you. Good morning. Good morning. I encourage you to be part of the conversation this morning. We're talking about how the wise decide. And I'm sharing from a book that I have here. However, I encourage you to call in if you have some insights on how the wise decide. And I've just put the number there, 646-915-8166. I thank you for taking the time to join me. So last week, when I started the conversation, we started off speaking about going to the source. And we were not finished, so I'm continuing going to the source this morning. And we are starting off with rules. We are going into the rules for going to the source. Bill George, Orem Smith, Mike Rutegers, and our exemplars of the value of going to the source. Their devotion to the quest for first-hand information set them apart from most people who feel inundated by meetings, emails, internal memos, and PowerPoint presentation. They produce the kind of market and financial success that clearly establishes the value of going to the source. When do I find time to go to the source? You may well ask. Follow our wise leaders' examples, and the time will create itself. Once you realize how valuable it is to go to the source, you will find opportunities to do it more often than you imagine possible. So rule number one is make it routine. Going to the source isn't about seminal visit to the operating room or one trip to a small town. Bill George and Orm Smith made vital discoveries during a single visit to an operating room and a single trip to New Zealand, respectively. But those discoveries were made because both leaders were able to put their observations in context. They used their personal experiences in the operating room and in New Zealand to collaborate the rest of the data they had, both from inside their companies and from many other observations. Outside the walls of their offices, Bill George knew the Medtronic catheters were a problem, but he hadn't experienced the extent of the problem until he docked a bloody catheter. Orm Smith knew small towns wanted Starbucks stores, but he also knew it would be difficult to manage and serve the stores. In small towns, he recognized the solution to meeting untapped demand in small towns in New Zealand because his mind was tuned to linking together disparate pieces of information. Making a routine to go to the source takes time. At the beginning of each year, Bill George blocked out large chunks of time on his schedule that he knew he wanted to devote to going to the source. He didn't always know in advance just where he would go or who he would see. But the time was reserved, and the rest of his schedule was built around those blocks of time. George traveled extensively to seek out resources, often combining a visit to a Medtronic facility somewhere in the world with meetings with doctors and observations in the operating room. Some of the time he blocked out was committed far in advance to such big events as American Heart Association annual meeting, a convocation that draws thousands of cardiologists, surgeons, and specialists. George would hole up in a luxurious hotel suite to meet with a few selected customers. Instead, He spent hours, about after hours, on his feet, either in the Medtronic exhibitor's booth or walking the nearby aisles to be available to physicians who might be upset about something or have an idea for a product. Spending time with employees included not only formal meetings at Medtronic facilities around the world, but also informal strolls through offices and labs. One day, George was walking through a lab when some researchers eagerly beckoned to him. They had just gotten permission from the Federal Communications Commission to use a tiny slice of radio frequency spectrum for a new device that would pick up information transmitted from the miniature computer implant in a person's body. For example, a defibrillator that stops erratic heartbeats. The FCC permission was the last hurdle they had to clear before the product could go commercial. When George told Medtronic's business planners about the breakthrough, they were unimpressed. It would be too costly and too risky, they said. But George had seen the excitement in the eyes of the researchers and knew they were confident they had a winner. Today, the technology is used to transmit information from patients at home to their doctor's offices over the internet and is a huge success. To spend all that time with doctors and Medtronic employees, George necessarily don't do some of the things that CEOs who aren't so devoted to getting first-hand information do. To do that, he formed an office of the chief executive that include himself, Vice Chairman Glenn Nelson, a physician with keen business skills, and Chief Operating Officer Art Collins, recruiting from Abbott Labs. His two colleagues took some of the burden of the CEO's job on their own shoulders, but George, who freed up some time for himself by cutting back on things such as budget meetings. If you let yourself, you can do budgets and expenses until the cows come home, he says. But that isn't where you make money. Our business is based on developing new products. You make money by tapping into customers and your employees for great new ideas and then implement them. Developing a routine for going to the source is all about discipline. You need to wander the halls of your own office to talk to people with whom you don't ordinarily come in contact. You need to schedule blocks of time in advance, and you need to make going to the source part of your trip, any trip that you take. If, like Bill George, you schedule time for going to the source far enough in advance, You can plan the rest of your schedule around those times with minimal disruption. You may not know when you schedule it how you will use each chunk of time. You can decide that when the time comes closer. If you are in marketing, for example, you may decide to spend 2 or 3 days observing how different retailers advertise and display your products. If you are planning to attend a trade professional organizational meeting, making your trip count, lectures and seminars are fine. Some of the panelists may be great sources, but be sure to carve out time to meet new people who might have useful insights. But don't restrict yourself to pre-scheduled times for going to the source or Simit. Assistants knew that every time he left the office on a business trip, he would want to visit half a dozen or more Starbucks wherever he was going. You can do the same thing by making it a point every time you leave the office to find a source to visit. I'm going to be going to rule 2 in a minute that speaks about develop permanent source. And I know that you are listening to this and you might be a small business owner or an entrepreneur. However, all of these points that I'm reading here, we can utilize. We can curtail and narrow this down to fit into our small businesses or as an entrepreneur. We don't need to be a big corporation to implement these rules. Rule number 2, develop permanent sources. Developing new sources of information is an important part of going to the source, but it is equally important to cultivate permanent contacts, people to whom you return time after time, to be able to read the changing labels of joy, frustration, or demand. Contact with permanent sources. People you must trust to be observant and honest with you may reveal little or no change for a long period of time. Then comes that day when something different catches your attention. Your source may not even realize what she's acting differently or saying things you haven't heard before. But if you are alert to those subtle signals, you will know to probe more deeply to have a root because of the change. One of the pioneers of American electronics industry, Paul Galvin, a true entrepreneur and thinker, employed his techniques for years. Galvin founded Galvin Manufacturing Corp. in 1928 to make simple electrical devices. He soon branches into the manufacturing radios and automobiles, and eventually changed the company's name to Motorola. Reflecting the focus on motor cars and music, Victorola, the Motorola grew. Galvin made it a point to keep his fingers on the pulse of not only the market, but also his other company. He would frequently walk through the manufacturing area, where he eventually met Motorola's first female assembly line worker, Mary Kulizga. Bob Galvin, who ultimately succeeded his father as CEO of Motorola, recalls that Mary worked in Department 5, the coil winding area. Each time Paul Galvin passed Mary's line, he would stop at her station to ask how she was doing. Usually, Mary would greet Paul with a cheerful hello and say what she was doing fine and the job was going well. But sometimes, Mary made it clear that things weren't going well. While respectfully, she would nevertheless tell Paul that the policy he had announced last week wasn't something that she thought was a good idea. Paul knew that if Mary didn't think the policy was a good idea, neither did most of her colleagues on the assembly line. That would set him to reconsider the wisdom of the policy, and sometimes he would order that it be changed over the objections of other executives. Who knew Mary was the source of Paul's change of mind? He didn't have to go ask 100 people. Bob Galvin recalls, he walk up to his office and he'd bring the big chute in and he would say, the decision I announced last Thursday, I'm going to have to change it. The people in the factory don't like it. Paul Galvin's regular visit to Mary and others were a permanent link to his employee. He was at the source looking for power of one observation that would tell him when things were off. When Mary, people in your own company can be valuable permanent sources. But keep in mind that meeting with the people in your company, especially those at much lower levels, can be disruptive if you are perceived to be treading on someone else's turf or looking to undermine others. Among Orem Simit's permanent resource of information about what was happening in Starbucks sources were the baristas who manned the front lines. Smith created a process that he called skip levels, in which he would get a conference room in a hotel in whatever town he was visiting and invite some baristas to meet with him without their boss. Smith would ask the baristas what the company could be doing better and what they thought was really going well. Virtually every such session would turn up little things that someone back at head office need to look into. But occasionally, a skip-level meeting could leave a big change, lead to big changes. Starbucks began selling merchandise in its store as another source of revenue and proof and profits. But the concept didn't go over very well with customers at first. When Smith brought up the Lucy results from merchandising in a skip-level meeting, one bold barrister spoke up. Nobody ever asked us what we think would sell in the stores, she said. When we get the boxes of stuff, we open them up and just laugh because we know it won't sell. Isn't that amazing? Continuing with going to the source. It was humorous on one level, but it was sad on another level, Smith recalls. The merchandising people weren't taking to our field, weren't talking to our field people about what to sell, and consequences of that skip level meeting is what merchandising now discuss with the field people what they'll be selling. Ordinarily, a boss included from meeting between his employee and someone from the headquarters wouldn't be very happy about it. But Smith institutionalized the skip level meeting so that it wasn't all about unusual. And he made it a point never to chastise a boss about anything he learned from the barristers. Store managers learned not to worry about their workers' meetings with the big boss because the sessions were explicitly not about finding out what was wrong so that someone would get called on the carpet. I didn't come back and whip my people for having overlooked something, he said. That wasn't the purpose. The purpose was to learn and change what could and to make a better decision next time. I just wanted to cut through the filtering of the organizational structure always does. Not because people try to keep things secret. It's just that organizations do. If I really want to understand what's happening, I have to talk to people who are down there doing things. Otherwise, I will wind up making poorer decisions, and my subordinates will make poorer decisions. Smith encouraged our managers to do skip meetings and keep rapidly caught up. They didn't like me coming in and telling them what I discover, he laughs. they would rather discover it first. You can develop permanent sources both inside and outside. Your company, within your own company, you can find useful sources among people with whom you aren't in regular contact, especially in functions difficult from your own. If you are a salesperson, make contacts with product engineer. Conversely, if you are a product engineer, reach out to salespeople. You will both be better for it and so will your company. Rule number three, find out who is driving. Going to the source is most effective when you go to the right source. What that may sound obvious, but it wasn't apparent to a Starbucks operations and real estate staff that the right source was people in small town. All they wanted to do was look at the demographics of Starbucks Metro customers and find what they stand to the rest of the country. Orming Smith knew better. He was looking ahead of to the future to see who would be driving Starbucks growth. And he had found those potential customers in small towns. He knew that customers outside of major cities were going to be the drivers of Starbucks' future. Ironically, it can be most difficult to understand who is driving the future of your organization. When business is at its best, John Whitehead was co-chairperson of Goldman Sachs in the late 1970s and the early 1980s, when the investment bank was enormously profitable and one of the preeminent investment banks in the nation. Its clientele, including the biggest and the best American companies, but Whitehead was worried. Among the big five investment banks, Goldman was the only one without international presence in the financial centers, such as London and Tokyo. Yet, the firm's clients were increasingly doing business abroad. Indeed, as early as 1967, before Whitehead had become co-chair, General Electric, one of Goldman's most important clients, had told the firm that it would be working with Goldman's arch rival, Morgan Stanley, to do an Eurobond issue because Goldman didn't have an international presence. Whitehead had considered the GE call a dark day of Goldman and began immediately pressing the firm to go international. The customers who had driven Goldman's very profitable rise to the top of the investment banking business were now showing the way abroad. It was up to Whitehead to go there. His customers led, but Whitehead's other partners weren't concerned. They wanted to use the firm's prestige and skills to win even more market share in the United States. Trying to go abroad would not only divert capital, both financial and intellectual, but that goal would, but it would also put Goldman into competition with formidable banks on their own home turf. We were so self-satisfied with the success of the domestic business, and we were growing so fast that everybody said, "Whitehead, you are rocking the boat. International, leave that to others." When Whitehead became co-chair, Goldman's international presence was almost non-existent. But in his powerful new role, he pushes to set up overseas offices beginning in London. The going was tough, though, and the London office, the sole component of the nascent international division, lost money in the first few years. Not uncommon, even when an investment bank enters new turf. There were still powerful opponents among Goldman's partners who opposed the international moves and used the losses as weapon to bulge on Whitehead. People would tell me that I was blowing serious money on the London venture, and that if this were an office in Chicago or Los Angeles, that we would fire the manager and close it down, Whitehead remembers. But Whitehead believed he had no choice but to press ahead with foreign operations. So he devised a subterfuge. He eliminated the international division as a separate profit center. From that point on, each domestic division of Goldman Investment Banking, trading equity sales, would absorb the appropriate losses from the international operations. The losses, of course, would simply disappear among the burgeoning domestic profits of each division. It was a little sneaky, but it worked very well, far better than I had ever anticipated, Whitehead says. Other people were eager now to get on board because the division heads wanted to make it profitable and invest more time, money, and people in making it profitable. Today, Goldman Sachs not only has a global presence in the investment banking, but in many big markets. It is also in the kingpin of investment banks, best in such formidable institutions as Deutsche Bank and its home turf in Germany. And it's all because John Whitehead paid close attention to the companies that use Goldman as an investment bank. It took him a while to overcome internal resistance, but he knew from Goldman's clients that the investment bank business was going global with or without Goldman Sachs. Internationalization was probably a risk-taking thing, but there was no alternative, he says. We might not succeed at it, but we had to try to do it. If we hadn't done it, Goldman Sachs really would have been more or less out of business, because now all investment banks is international. To figure out who is driving your company now and who may be driving it in the future, make a list. Start with the people with whom you interact regularly now. Add to that list each of those people's bosses and their key direct report. Now, you have two new layers to think about. If someone on your original list of regular contact isn't really driving your company's future, one of the other two, one layer above and one layer below, almost certainly is. Now, think ahead 5 years. How many of those people on your current list will be critical to your company's future 5 years from now? More important, think about who is not on that list, who will be important in driving your company. That is, future drivers who weren't there now. Now you have the list of some of the key drivers who should be among your sources for getting firsthand information. Once you have identified who is driving your company, both now and in the future, you can do what Mike Rutegers did routinely. Improve the quality of your time with those people by thinking more in advance about how you can transform what seem to be routine encounters into opportunities to probe and ask questions that you haven't asked before. Your contacts can provide you with new perspective or firsthand information about your products and how they refuse. Rule number 4. Empathy is essential. We know that there are biases and assumptions that color the information we get from filtered sources. But what about our own biases and assumptions? People hear what they want to hear, not necessarily what is being said. It's important in reaching the right decision that we put ourselves in the position of the source and try to understand what the source is saying from the source's perspectives. think about Oren Simit, there, here was a high-paid, powerful executive living in Seattle, one of the nation's greatest cities, yet he was able, in part because of his small-town origins, to put himself in the shoes of the residents of small towns and see how powerful their desires was to have a Starbucks where they live. Mike Rutherford put himself in the shoes of a harried CIO and thought about what that person needs to get things done more effectively and efficiently. It's called empathy, defined as a feeling of concern and understanding of others, situations, and feeling. It is essential to decision making. In fact, it's at the heart of people, of some of the most consequential decisions that Associate Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer makes. His reasoning is, of course, of a 17-year-old boy, illustrates how he applies the skill of putting himself in someone else's shoes. The U.S. Supreme Court decides the most important and vexing case that caused our country, that arises in our country, if they weren't so difficult to solve, they would make it all the way to the High Court. Justice Breyer takes his job seriously and brings such intensive to his decision that he needs several days to rest at the end of the Supreme Court session, just to clear his head. When writing an opinion, he normally has to begin twice from scratch, revise as he goes along, consider one example, Yarbrough versus Alvarado, include a murder of a 17-year-old boy. The boy was brought to police station, but in a room and questioning by the police about a homicide. After 2 hours of questioning, the boy confessed of being involved in the murder. He was not. However, given the standard Miranda warning before the police began questioning him. A Miranda warning is what Hollywood is referring to when an officer barks out, read him his rights. You are probably heard the police on Law and Order recite the warning. You have the right to remain silent. By law, the police must read someone the Miranda warning. If that person is not free to leave, such as when a suspect is arrested, the rule is that when you are in confinement, if you think you are not free to leave, then the police have to give you a Miranda warning. But if you are free to leave, then they don't. In this case, they didn't give the boy a Miranda warning, and he was later convicted of murder. The case before the court was about the boy's right, not about whether he was involved in the murder. The question should he have been entitled to a Miranda warning. The outcome of the Supreme Court wrote was 5-4 against the boy. The court concluded that since the boy was free to leave at any time, he was not entitled to a Miranda warning, and thus the right where he violated. But Justice Breyer's dissent makes clear that he thought there was a more basic question at the heart of the case. Did he reasonably think he was free to leave? The key question was not what he personally happened to think, but what would a reasonable person in his situation think? So Justice Breyer put himself in the shoes of the 17-year-old boy, though thrown into question at a police station. Would a boy that age understand that he could leave freely at any time? Breyer dissent, which required many versions ties to convey to the reader what it would be like to be that 17-year-old boy. From the distance, Alvarado hears from his patients, from his parents that he is needed for police questioning. The parents take him to the station. On arrival, a police officer separates him from his parents. His parents ask to come along, but the officer says they may not. Another officer says, What do we have here? We are going to question a suspect. The police take Alvarado to a small interrogation room away from the station's public area. A single officer begins to question him, making clear in the process that the police have the evidence that he participated in an attempted carjack connected with a murder. When he says that he never saw any shooting, the police suggested that he's lying, while adding that she is giving him the opportunity to tell the truth and take care of himself. Today, the end of the questioning, toward the end of the questioning, the officer gives him permission to take a bathroom or water break. After 2 hours, by which time he has admitted he was involved in the attempted theft, knew about the gun and helped to hide it, the questioning ends. What reasonable person in the circumstances brought to the police station by his parents at police request, put in a small interrogation room questioning for a solid 2 hours, and confronted with the claims that there is a strong evidence that he participated in a serious crime, would have thought of himself, well, anytime I want to leave, I can just get up and walk out. If the person harbored any doubts, would he still think he might be free to leave? Once he recalls that the police officer has just refused to let his parents remain with him during the questioning, would he still think that he, rather than the officers, controls the situation? Brea was putting himself in the boy's shoes, trying to understand that if it was like to be a 17-year-old boy being questioned by the police in a small interrogation room. Brea was asking, what would a reasonable 17-year-old do? In this situation, think. Instead of what would a reasonable person in his situation think. He wanted his readers to put themselves in the same position to understand what the 17-year-old think differently. Justice Breyer's dissent also makes clear that he thought there could be another similar situation involved. Suppose that he was Hispanic, spoke little English. The police didn't speak Spanish, and there was no translator. Brea's message, put yourself in this position. Justice Breyer's dissent also makes clear that he thought there could be other similar circumstances involved. Suppose, I just read that. Whether you agree with Justice Breyer's opinion in this case, his empathy highlights a critical element of processing information from the source. Isn't putting yourself in a boy's shoes fact by fact the best way to access what he would reasonably think? Whether you are viewing case facts like Justice Stephen Breyer's, meeting with customers like Mike Reuters, and observing doctors like Bill George, you must try to interpret the source from the perspective to avoid adding your own biases. That is so powerful. And as I mentioned before, although we are entrepreneurs and small business people, these are pointers that we can use in our own businesses each and every day. Okay, I just had to moisten my throat there. And now we are going to start chapter 3. of how the wise decide. I mean, chapter 2, excuse me. How the wise decide, chapter 2, deals with fill a room with barbarians. Now, would you like to work for a boss who requires you and your colleagues to sit in a tiny conference room arguing with one another for hours every time he had to make a tough decision? Most of us try to avoid conflict, yet conflict is exactly what Dean Kamen, founder of DKA Research and Development Corporation, seeks and encourages. Carmen, whose company focuses on such radical new technologies as delivering chemotherapy to infants and helping people with kidney failure live a normal life, finds that bringing together people with diverse backgrounds and well-informed opinions is vehemently argued with positions helps him make his toughest decisions. I like it when 10 people walk into the room with 10 different opinions and are so passionate that they are yelling at each other, says Carmen. Yet he admits that if someone from outside attended one of those meetings, they would think we are all barbarians. Not all decisions require intensive and full-throated argument. But when the choice is tough and there is no clear path forward, a hearty debate can be the best tool you have for uncovering the right solution. We are talking about seeking compromise. Tough decisions, by their nature, brook no compromise. Otherwise, they would be tough. They wouldn't be tough. To get the best thing from their team, wise leaders actively seek dissent. Seeking and fostering dissent provides two averages. First, it forces the participant to expose their opinions to a wide range of counter-argument. The strengths and weaknesses of such opinion surface for all to see and think about as each viewpoint is tested against the strongest possible challenge. Second, diverse and well-founded arguments can reframe a problem so that each one sees it in a new way. Suddenly, a unique solution can emerge that no one had considered before, yet argument alone can solve problems. While leaders understand that as important as it is to bring into open various points of view, it is equally important that the decisions take place in what we call a culture of candor in which employees are comfortable expressing their own perspective, and just as comfortable working together to implement the resulting decision. I expect people to walk into the room carrying spears, ready to defend their positions, says Kamen. My job is to decide when we have had enough battle and make a decision. And when people leave the room, everybody goes to be working together the same goal. Vigorous debate can easily degenerate into chaos and unfocused shout fest that leaves participants angry and resentful and unsatisfied. And while little or no progress made together toward the decision, that's why creating the culture of candor is so important. Participants accept and embrace the highly changed atmosphere of the room. They know that when it is over, there will be no winners or losers, just honest opinions, honestly rendered. People can say whatever they want as long as they avoid personal attacks. When a person presents an opinion and everyone is expected to come prepared and to have an opinion, it is expected that others will challenge it, and the leader, you may facilitate the debate, but your opinions are no more valuable than and just as valuable as attack as another else. Truth is the goal. And when the decision is finally emerges, everyone is expected to sign on to support it. An established culture of candor goes beyond just ensuring that the barbarians in the room walk out willing to move forward with the decision. It also makes people more lively and productive and inspiring them to better personal relations with their peers. If the debates are done in the right atmosphere, people will look forward to the sessions, but most important of all, when a culture of candor is established, consensus is no longer needed to keep the peace. Leaders can make the right decisions rather than interfere and compromise decisions. Our quality stinks. Bob Galvin was worried. Since succeeding his legendary father, Paul, as the CEO of Motorola, Galvin has spent 20 years building the company's reputation and profits. Outsiders saw an innovative company that had been at the forefront of electronics and communications technology, including papers, including pagers, two-way radio, semiconductors, and growing Calvin tenure as CEO, sales has risen from $200 million to $3 billion. Yet, in 1979, Galvin knew that something was amiss. I had a sense that somehow we really weren't tackling all the problems we needed to tackle, says Galvin. Like other American manufacturing companies, Motorola was feeling increasing competitive pressure from Japan. Galvin felt Motorola was ripe for a big change. Without knowing what the change was, he is sued a call. Calvin felt Motorola was ripe for a big change. Without knowing what the change was, he issued a call to an action to his top officers. He summoned all 80 of the top managers from around the world to Motorola's first ever company-wide office meeting. A three-day affair to be held at the Embassy West Hotel in downtown Chicago. The mission mapped out new initiatives for Motorola Corporation's renewal. Many managers weren't happy about the idea. Motorola executives were productive, effective, and frugal. Some of them, knowing that they could speak candidly to Calvin, rumbled to him about the expense in both time and money of spending 3 days in Chicago hotel. Others hated the idea of formal dinner Saturday night at which they could be required to wear tuxedos. But Galvin urged them to keep an open mind and think about the future of their company. He had outlined an agenda that included broad topics such as the customers, the integrity, the people, and were designed to inspire renewed confidence and a sense of purpose. But he also set out some narrow topics about such things as how to better transfer information from engineer to factories. He hopes the wide range of agenda would spark decisions and would show him how to set the company on a new path. The meeting began on Friday, April 1979, and opened with a speech by Carl Lindholm, a vice president whose topic was how to get along with the chief executive officer. The speech gently mocked the three-person office of the chief executive, which included Galvin, Bill Wisely, and John Mitchell, referring to them as the three bears and the Holy Trinity, but it
also contains some hard truths about how the three top executives didn't always listen carefully, whether available when they were needed or sometimes acted a little like officious. It was the funniest damn speech, and he got a lot of laughs, Calvin said. But he also found some faults that he called us on when we said, fine, we will have to fix that. I gave the meeting substance because people were talking the truth, the reality that we all have to figure out a way to do things better. By Saturday afternoon, most of the executives were thoroughly engaged in a wide range of discussion about reviewing their company. Then, in a short question and answer session before a scheduled refreshment break, Art Sundry stood up. Art was a respected figure about Motorola executive. As the national sales manager for two-way radios, he was running Motorola's most profitable business with an outstanding 85% global market share. Everyone turned their attention to what he would say. When we aren't talking about most important subjects, and I am afraid we are going to go through this entire meeting and never talk about it, he said. The subject we ought to be talking about is that our quality stinks. It took a moment for that statement to sink in among the executives. Motorola was a reverted company and household name. Its quality assurance program had produced some significant advances. Yet, here was the guy running the most successful business, and he was saying the company quality stinks. Art pretty much puts the rebus on everything else in the question and answer period, Galvin says. So we go to our refreshment break, and everybody was talking. They were saying things like, whoa, that was a powerful statement. And you know what? He's right. And I thought my quality was pretty good. Maybe Art's seen something I'm not. The entire focus of the meeting suddenly changed. Quality became the first and foremost issue of the table. Each executive did some soul searching, and most could confess that the quality of their business unit wasn't as good as it should be. At that night's formal dinner, all the conversations were about quality. The executives were so involved in the discussion about quality that they didn't even complain about having to wear tuxedos. By the end of the weekend session, Galvin and the officers decided to focus on product quality as the best way to reinvigorate Motorola. They reached that conclusion only after one of their colleagues had spoken his mind, but without fear of retribution or ridicule. It was part of the culture of candor that Bob Galvin had cultivated for years, a lesson he had learned from his father and one that had benefited him when he was a young executive with no engineering background, depending upon the people under him for guidance. It was well known in the organization that you could speak up your presence, he says. Our people knew they could say anything in front of me. I didn't think that in other companies Sondre could have had the courage to stand up in front of so many people and say the company quality stinks. But he knew he could do that at Motorola. We had created an atmosphere in which people could speak and influence the company. Sondre's statement touches a nerve among his colleagues because they recognize the truth of his harsh remark. Sondre himself brought the subject to their attention because he was getting complaints from police department, truckers, taxi drivers, and other Motorola two-way radios. And that was just in his business unit. Any one of the 88 executives could have pointed to others. Evidence that had been mounting for some time. They all knew, for example, that what had happened to Motorola's television business. From their inception, television sets had been manufactured using vacuum tubes, which, along with other components, were prone to frequent failure, a trend that gave rise to a fast-growing profession, television repair. Eventually, the invention of transmitters allowed electronics manufacturers not only to get rid of the tubes, but also to use much smaller within a television set. Motorola was in front of that trend. In 1967, the company introduced its state quasar model, which boasted of its works in the drawer. A repair man could easily unplug and replace a failed circuit in the field rather than hauling a television set in his shop. Japanese electric manufacturers took another route as Japan rebuilt its industrial base after World War II. Many industries, including the automotive and electronic industries, were eager to free themselves from their repetitive with cheap, flimsy products. To do that, they paid close attention to the teachings of the people such as Joe Juran and W. Edwards Deming, American engineers and statistical analysts, who preached a gospel of careful quality control that ensured a product was made right the first time. In their philosophy, there was no room for their failure. While Motorola was pioneering better ways to fix television sets, Chinese manufacturers were making television sets that did not need to be fixed. The result was humbling: erosion of marketing share for Motorola. Galvin and his colleagues saw the trend going decisively to the Japanese and sold Motorola television operations to Mitsubishi in 1974. Then came another humiliation when Mitsubishi manufactured television set in a former Motorola factory was using the same equipment, and some of the same workers began churning out television sets in 1/20th failure rates of the Motorola sets that had been built there. Quality had been a part of Motorola Etro for years, but it was focused mostly on services to customers, not engineering and manufacturing. After the Chicago meeting, Galvin himself set out to see how Motorola's quality was by visiting many of the company's customers. "I did not want to see any big shots," he recalled. "I wanted to see the people who installed, who serviced, who wrote the checks to us, who receive the material, who assembled it into their products, the purchase people, and so on." The results were so sobering. After just 4 visits, he predicted that he would hear from customers, "He will do business with you, but would do 10 or 20 or 30%, maybe over 300% more businesses with you if you would just stop making so many mistakes." The mistakes they cited range from incorrect invoices that had to be corrected to DOA, dead on arrival radios. "We had become too tolerant of errors because we are just doing better than GE, better than RCA, better than others in our business," Calvin said. "If we ship 50 radios to a police department and 2 of them didn't work, we'd say, 'Gee, 4% of them didn't work.' But if I got a 96% from my teachers in school, that was pretty good. The thing that was so bad about the quality was that the customer didn't like it. If we make a mistake, the customer was inconvenienced and had to do something two or three times to get it right. Art didn't have to draw us a picture. He just awakened us because it was the best of our business. It was imperfect. But recognizing that quality was a problem and doing something about it, there were two different problems. About the Chicago weekend meeting, Motorola's executives were taking the quality problem seriously, but without achieving much. Monday morning, people returned to their offices and started to work on quality control, recalls Galvin. They didn't know what formally they were supposed to do, but they did a little bit where and a little bit there. A little bit here and a little bit there. Clearly wasn't going to solve Motorola's quality problem. And Galvin decided to push harder. I became impatient with the fact that my senior associates, who were doing a remarkable job as a general manager, were focused all too much of the budget and forecast on things like that. Those are essential, but quality wasn't being given the same amount of attention. And I finally lost patience with that fact. Quality deserves equal status. So I proclaim that from that point forward, quality would be the first subject that every agenda, from the board meeting to every other meeting in the country. Then came the big break. A meticulous engineer and quality assurance executive took advantage of Calvin's culture of candor. Bill Smith called the CEO to tell him that he may have found the answer to Motorola's quest for quality. I knew Bill Smith was a top engineer in our communications business. Though I did not know Bill very well, Calvin says, he said, "Bob, I have got an important idea and concept. I have got to express to you, and I think it is very important in the company. I would like to see you." Galvin quickly set aside time to meet with Smith. The engineer laid out for Galvin a sophisticated theory of how latent defects in industrial process and produce create failures in the customer's dissatisfaction. I have to admit, I did not understand what Bill was talking about. Galvin recalls, but he adds, "I was sure as the devil I understood that he knew what he was talking about." Galvin invited Sumit back to the next day to explain it all again and began to understand the implementations of Sumit ideas for the proven quality. Then he sent Sumit to see two senior executives with engineering background. They understood almost immediately that he was what he was talking about and emphatically began to figure out how to put Sumit's concept to work. While based on statistical quality control ideas that had been developed and implemented by people like Juran and Demir, Sumit's unique approach to using these ideas became what is known today as Six Sigma, a Motorola trademark and the most widely utilized quality control process in the world. When Bob Galvin retired as Motorola's chairman in 1990, Six Sigma was saving the company $700 million a year, and Motorola's was competing head-to-head with the Japanese electronics tycoons. It all started with the culture of candor that let people like Art Sunder speak their mind without fear of reprisal or recrimination. Next week, we are going to continue the conversation and how the wise decide, and we will be picking up Better Your Best. I am praying that as we gather this information here, that we will find value added for our businesses and we can embrace a lot of the information that I'm giving you here from this book and turn around our businesses. We do not need to be big corporations to implement these. As entrepreneurs and small business people, we can implement these and turn them around to grow our business, enhance our lives, and for those that have employees, to enhance the lives of our employees. I encourage you to connect with me on Twitter at Dynamic Daphne. My fan page on Facebook is Dynamic Daphne, facebook.com/DynamicDaphne. Please like my fan page. And I'm encouraging you to also like the page for the National NAPW page on Facebook. We are a chapter here in the Litchfield, the greater Litchfield area, and we are looking to just get as many women involved. It's a phenomenal organization. There are in excess of 400 chapters nationally, and there are great opportunities, and it gives you the power to be you. So let me hear from you. Our Litchfield meeting is coming up on the 28th of May at 432 Bantam Road in Litchfield, Connecticut. If you have a story to share, I want you to reach out to me. Send me a message here in the inbox on the radio. Or email me dynamicdaphne1@gmail.com. Let's have a pre-show dialogue so we can talk about what it is you have to share. I look forward to seeing you again on Sunday evening when we will again be on this broadcast live sharing different stories to make a difference in other people's lives. I am so honored to be the host of this show. Thank you for your continuous support. Mark the show favorite and encourage others to listen to this segment. Again, go out there. Begin to use these tips and techniques like the wise uses to make their decision. Let us go out there and begin to make powerful decisions. Let us find relationships to partner with to excel in that which we are doing. I believe in you because you are created for greatness. I encourage you to go out there and do something that you have never done before. And call the show up and tell me about what it is so we can celebrate and rejoice together. Stay focused, stay the course, and continue doing what you were created to do.
Thank you. I can almost see the breaking of day. It's just that I know what I know. You may not be able to touch it right now. Begin to thank him. Begin to praise him. Begin to thank him. Begin to praise him. Begin to thank him. Begin to praise him. Hallelujah. Can you see it? Can you feel it? Everybody. You're going into a new dimension tonight. You'll never ever see it again the same way. You'll never ever touch it again the same way. You've been called with a great call. It's a monumental call. You've been called to change.